This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
This is 5 Live with Movie Conversation. Let's bring in Toby Jones now, because in last weekend's Observer, Mark tipped Toby as best actor for next week's Oscars for his role in Infamous, where he plays Truman Capote. Hello, Toby. How are you?
I'm fine, Simon. How are you?
I'm extremely well.
Good.
How long do we have you for, just out of interest?
No, you have me for as long as you need me, Simon.
Would you... We're just going to do the box office top 10. Do you want to join in that?
I don't know the tune. Is there a tune?
No. Okay. No. You hum it. I'll sing it. So what happens is I just go through the top 10 movies, and then Mark gives a sort of a pithy, six paragraph version of what he thinks of the movie.
Short, sweet, and to the point.
And if you have anything to contribute at that point, you could just join in, Toby.
Yeah, and watch my career go up in flames. No thanks.
You don't want to do it?
I don't want to do the joining in and giving my opinion on other people's performances. No.
Oh, you're just a chicken, mate. You are.
No, I'm an actor. I'm very aware of the effect I have on other people.
Okay, well, we'll rip through this far quicker than we do normally. At 10, White Noise 2, The Light.
Rubbish the first time, rubbish the second time.
Happy Feet at 9.
I mean, you know, we got to be nice to them because they can tap dance. Doesn't work for me.
Employee of the Month at 8.
Boring in one ear and out the other.
Apocalypto at 7.
The work of a madman, but not in a bad way.
We haven't done it this fast, but I feel all insecure. Casino Royale at 6.
Don't take your under 12-year-old kids to see it. Daniel Craig puts the franchise back on its feet.
The Last King of Scotland at 5.
Forrest Whitaker is Idi Amin. And do you think he will, if he wins the award, he will do what Helen Mirren did and say, "You didn't fall in love with me, you fell in love with Idi Amin"?
We tried that line a few days ago.
I know.
You can say positive stuff, Toby, by the way.
Well, It's good. I'm listening. I'm enjoying it.
No, but, I mean, positive things about the movie, not about us.
I haven't seen a lot of these films, actually.
Yeah, he doesn't want to talk other people's product up.
Miss Potter at 4.
Horrible! Absolutely horrible. And Renee Zellweger doing that. Oh, I'm English! Oh, look at me doing English! I'm pursing my lips and doing English! And incidentally, it is alleged that Renee, then in her absolute genius, went off on one about, oh, yeah, it was really horrible having to make the film because of Silent Field and the Isle of Man's. Renee, stay in Texas. And incidentally, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4 is available on video. Just buy that and remind yourself from whence Miss Zellweger came.
Smoking Aces, this week's number 3.
The word empty doesn't even begin to describe the emptiness which fills the black hole of that film.
Is there a better word than empty, then?
Bereft.
Well, why didn't you use that?
Because I wanted to give you something to say.
Night at the Museum, not Night of Museum, as it says.
Night of Museum, yes. Well, you know, Night of Museum is a better title. Again, I mean, it's nonsense. It's a shame Ricky Gervais turns up and does not very much in it. And, you know, it's Jumanji in the museum, and it's not as good as Zathura.
The Pursuit of Happiness is the UK's number one.
It's the live-action version of Dumbo, in that it's pain, 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 with 10 seconds of it's all right at the end. I mean, I think that Will Smith's performance is, you know, is very engaging, and the kid is very good at being his son, although it turns out the kid really is his son, and it maybe would have been less painful if I'd known that at the end of it the guy turns out to be a multimillionaire. But it was like watching 2 hours of everything going horribly wrong, and then at the end it's okay.
There is something
it's
wrong
very
here.
Sappy.
There is something wrong here. We've reduced Toby Jones to the role of guffaw off mic.
I was trying to keep a score for you there, and I think one got 1 point and there were 2 half points. That's 2 out of 10, isn't it?
No, I liked Apocalypto.
Weren't you at university with Mark?
Mark was leaving as I was entering, isn't that right, Mark?
Toby was on that sort of circle of drama people. He was very good friends with a very good friend of mine called Ollie, and so I knew him around and about.
I think you had a friend at university.
I did have a friend, yes. He was called Ollie. I rented him. I think Toby shared him, and so we nodded at each other occasionally across crowded common rooms.
I think actually, when you used to be in a band, and I think one time I compared.
Oh, I'd completely forgotten that. That's absolutely right. Toby compared an evening with the Railtown Bottlers, an evening of skiffle and joy.
Yep.
We should play a clip. Do you want to just set up the basic idea, Toby, of your movie here?
Well,
I could get Mark to do it if you don't want to.
Yeah, do get Mark to do it, because I have done it before.
Okay, it's a story about Truman Capote, and this may seem strangely familiar to people who've seen Capote. It's a story about Truman Capote and his relationship with the subjects of his famous book, In Cold Blood, which is one of the first sort of journalistic novelizations, if you will, of a real crime. And it's an extraordinary story about celebrity and the way in which celebrity interacts with the public. I'm referring back now to your completely throwaway and infantile reference to Big Brother, this is kind of where it all began. At the centre of it is this extraordinary character of Truman Capote, played extraordinarily, I thought, by Philip Seymour Hoffman, until I saw Infamous and saw him played more extraordinarily, and I really never thought I'd say that, by Toby Jones.
Did you have to suck lemons to get that kind of facial posture, Toby?
No, I had to do quite a lot of work. Not sucking lemons, I did pretty much everything else. I worked with a voice coach for about 2 months, and we worked out that his teeth, if you can, the best way to describe it is his teeth must have been directly over each other. You know, there wasn't that gap that we all have. And so you have to move your jaw forward. I was very struck by that when I first heard him speak and saw him speak, if you like, with the jaw being very protruding. And in order to get myself into a position where I wasn't just constantly in pain, I'd have to do that for about an hour a day, do a sort of warm up for that. And then I'd stay in that voice all day. And I think that some of the actors who were joining on set thought I was deep in character, but I was only deep in voice.
Can I just say, before we move on that, the Venus competition,
yes,
if you're doing it for real and you want the tickets to the screening, it's a phone-only thing, OK? It's 0500 999 693. The jokes and all other references to Mark's more kind of illustrious question are via email and text.
Exactly.
Thank you very much. You understood that, Toby, didn't you?
I think so, yes.
I think most people can understand. Now, for better or for worse, this will, you know, be known as the second Capote movie, won't it?
Yeah.
How can you overcome that? Because from what Mark says, your performance is better than the great Philip Seymour Hoffman.
And the great Philip Seymour Hoffman performance is great. I'm not doing it down at all. It is great. I did not think it was toppable, but it is a great performance. But this is better.
Well, in a sense, that's not my job. I just have to persuade people to go and trust the reviewers that they go and see it. Because obviously I'm going to defend our film. What I would say is that the film was written and directed by Doug McGrath, who did Emma, and perhaps more significantly in this case, he co-wrote Bullets Over Broadway, for which he was nominated for an Oscar. And I think that our film has this very, I think, when I first read it, was this incredible structure of balancing the comedy that Truman Capote must have had about him, the wit that he must have had about him, to matter to anyone in the first place. And it manages to balance this with the pathos that his subsequent decline was witnessed by everyone on every chat show in America, because he sort of very publicly fell apart through drugs and drink. And I think that one of the ways that our film is different, I think, is that George Plimpton, to begin with, but then Doug in his screenplay, locate the moment of decline from this moment of hanging of Perry Smith, and the fact that Truman recognised in Perry Smith, if not a potential love, then certainly someone who he twinned with to a sort of fatal degree and fell apart as a result. But this whole thing is couched in the comedy and the tragedy are juxtaposed in such an elegant way that I'm of all the things that I think have suffered as a result of the comparison is the way that this screenplay hasn't been acknowledged as a remarkable screenplay, really.
And Perry Smith, played by
Daniel Craig, resurrecting the Capote franchise.
Yeah. Whatever happened to Daniel Craig?
He's working with George Lazenby at the moment, isn't he?
It's one of those things, isn't it? I don't know. But in that clip, you can hear he's almost unrecognisable as well. Also, his hair and everything are different. He looks very, very different in our film.
And don't you get to kiss him?
Now, I have to side with Mark on this, and you seem to be reducing it to the lowest common denominator again, Simon. I do kiss him, but there are moments of eroticism far more daring than that in the film.
Okay.
Most of them involve Toby wearing a coat. One of the most incredible things about Capote.
Is it possible to be erotic wearing a coat?
No, strangely, you have to see the film in order to get it. I mean, one of the most extraordinary things about Capote is that if you do a very good version of him, it's almost as if you're doing a pastiche, because he almost a pastiche for himself. He was somebody who kind of had developed a character. I mean, I was very interested in Capote because I was always interested in the sort of what I consider to be the duplicity of In Cold Blood. Mm. Actually, I think the key difference between the two films in terms of the structure of the films themselves is that, if anything, Capote, the movie, is primarily influenced by things like The Journalist and the Murderer, the Janet Malcolm thesis about the way in which journalism and the subjects are. And I find that absolutely fascinating. And I have to confess that actually that's the thing that as a film itself wins me over in terms of Capote. But in terms of Infamous, the thing that won me was the fact that I think you get a very, very intimate portrayal of Truman Capote. And certainly it takes a much more personal look at his relationship with the character that Daniel Craig plays, and is sort of, you know, more personally adventurous in that area. And as I said, I know it must be like a bit like a stuck record. It is one of those things in which there are many things about Infamous which are worthwhile. I still love Capote, but I still think that it's one of those, even if the film was falling around itself, Toby Jones's performance is so striking, is so outstanding, that it is worth the price of his admission almost on its own. I don't say that lightly, because I think one of the great problems with it is that doing that performance after Philip Seymour Hoffman has won an Oscar already means that, you know, you can pretty much guarantee when you and I are doing the Oscar show on Tuesday, we're not going to hear Toby's name. And it's a shame, because in any other year you would do, because it's such a remarkable performance.
And that's why you're speechless. That's why you're on the show, Toby.
Going back to what Mark said originally there about, I think this was the thing that anyone who, you know, and hopefully you'll see a fantastic documentary at some point about from the Maisel brothers, which follows Truman Capote. It's a little half 30-minute documentary where they follow him on his publicity tour for In Cold Blood. And this was the thing I was sent to prepare for the screen test. And what struck me as absolutely terrifying as an actor was the level of performance from Capote that was going on. As Mark says, this sort of, he seems to be almost a pastiche of himself. And I think that where Doug did a brilliant job in the screenplay is, in one way, our film is the story of the collapse of that performance, if you like, the way that the performance serves Capote well and then falls apart once it's sort of like put under question by Perry Smith, you know, Daniel Craig's character. And it's really about the collapse of a performance, and in a way that's what made it such a huge pleasure to play this screenplay, really. The performance serves Capote well and then falls apart once it's sort of like put under question by Perry Smith, you know, Daniel Craig's character. And it's really about the collapse of a performance, and in a way that's what made it such a huge pleasure to play this screenplay, really.
Interesting email here from Justin. Toby was in my friend's first ever short film. Lord. It was called I Hate My Neighbour and I Want Him to Die. He was absolutely brilliant.
Renée Zellweger up for that role originally?
Do you remember what you played in this movie, Toby?
I think I was the neighbour.
No, it says here you were the bovine fertilisation technician.
Yes, I do. That's beginning to ring bells. I haven't played too many of those.
Bovine fertilisation technician who gets blown up by a dog and some dynamite.
That's right. It's all coming back to me now. Classic short film, don't you think?
It sounds as though it's worth looking. It's probably almost certainly on YouTube.
And you could everything just, is.
You could watch
on the
all
list
of, it
of things I've played. I once played a transgenic pig stroke Elvis Presley, but I think the bovine fertilisation expert is right up there.
We've mentioned some pretty extraordinary roles, Toby. Where does trying to work out how to do this film fit in with all those? I mean, it sounds, just from that vocal bit that we heard, extraordinarily difficult to do.
Well, it was difficult. I mean, you know, it's without sounding like an actor.
Go ahead.
In a way, I'm kind of, but, you know, as an actor, you know, somewhere you start off with this great dream of transformation, and very little work actually ever presents you with the opportunity to totally transform yourself. And the fear and excitement I had in playing this part was sort of immense, and that, on many levels. One, because I just couldn't think of how on earth I was going to become this guy who, as we've already established, was such a performance of himself. But then secondly, it was also going to a different culture and playing with all of these very much more experienced actors. Quite an intense, well, a very intense film. I think that was the most terrifying thing. And I suppose, you know, it's hard to talk about satisfaction, but the satisfaction is having a tilt at it and feeling that you haven't sort of let yourself down. There's nothing else you could have done, really.
well, not only have you not let yourself down, Mark thinks that you should be up there and getting a nomination on Tuesday. Chances are you won't, he says, but, you know,
I think it's in the American imagination, it's an impossibility that I will.
I mean, it would be hilarious if 2 years running, somebody won an Oscar for playing Truman Capote. I mean, it ain't going to happen, but there we go.
What do we see you in next, Toby, after Infamous?
Yeah, The Painted Veil, which is a film by John Curran, who did We Don't Live Here Anymore, which is a little indie that came out a couple of years ago. And didn't do very well here, but did very well in the States. But it stars Naomi Watts and Edward Norton, and we shot it in rural China. And I think whatever the film's like, you'll see China in a way that no one will have shot it before. I know that's a dangerous thing to say with Mark in the room, but it's a Somerset. It's an adaptation of. It's the third time actually that the film has been adapted.
I think Philip Seymour Hoffman's just completed his version. Hasn't
he has, yeah.
That's right, with Truman Capote in it.
A lot of rural China.
Digitally remastered to appear in it.
Toby, good to talk to you. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much. Cheers,
Toby Jones, who you clearly have to see. In Infamous, because if he's better than Oscar-winning Philip Seymour Hoffman,
who was very good,
that's some performance. More reviews to come, and your emails and the answers to our two competitions. We have a posh one and a prize-winning one. In fact, Gary in Wolverhampton said, "Is the competition akin to the Times crossword with a cryptic and quick coffee time version?"
Exactly, it is.
I must be sub jade. I don't understand either. Daniel in Edinburgh says, "The poster of Venus. The poster is based on Eduardo Manet's Olympia, which in turn refers to Titian's Venus of Urbino, which in turn refers to Giorgione's Sleeping Venus. But really, the poster is done after Scarlett Johansson's lounging in Lost in Translation, and what a lounging it was."
Okay.
Completely and utterly wrong, but worth reading
out.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, interesting.
This from Will says, "I think it's Botticelli's Venus. P.S. Mark is a plonker," which might be true, but he knows his Botticelli from his Velasquez. The answer being...
Well, it is, you know, and it's funny, but almost the first thing we all said was, oh, it's Botticelli, but then it's the Velasquez Venus, so...
Is this the Rockaby Venus?
Yes, exactly.
The Toilet of Venus.
The Toilet of Venus, yes.
To give it its correct title.
Yes.
Anyway, so if you got that right... Very good. You get absolutely no prizes, just a sort of a certain smug expression which you can wear between now and 4 o'clock. We should do a review or four. What's first up?
Back in the 90s, when I used to go to Cannes all the time, which I've started doing again recently for my sins, I spent an exciting, like, 5 hours once chasing around Sylvester Stallone because I had to interview him because he just made this film Copland, in which he was acting. You know, Copland's an interesting film, actually.
It's pretty good, isn't it?
And I remember the thing that he said to me when I finally caught up with him and got him for 3.5 minutes after spending 5 hours chasing around. He said, well, the thing is, you know, now I'm, you know, going up a little bit. You're not going to see me doing, like, Rocky VI, you know. Of course, since Copland, which is a very good movie but didn't make a whole bunch of money, he has done things like, you know, Get Carter and Detox, and things haven't really been going so well. So now, despite what he said back then, we have Rocky Balboa, or, to give it its unofficial title, Rocky VI. And apparently, coming up very soon, we've got Rambo, is it 4 or 5? The Pearl of the... It's got some subtitle like the Pirates of the Caribbean. What's it called? Pearl of the Cobra, with Johnny Depp's going to tell, all right, hello, I'm Johnny Depp. You know, I'm in the wrong film, man. Oh, no, it's terrible. Anyway, so, Rocky VI, Rocky Balboa to you. All this time has passed since the last Rocky movie, Rocky V, which actually wasn't bad. The key thing about all the Rocky movies is Rocky has to be the underdog, okay? Otherwise, Rocky doesn't work. And if he wins things, and then you've got a big problem with the next movie because you have to make him the underdog. Actually, Rocky V was a very, very good example of how you knock somebody down, make them the underdog, and start all over again. He has to go back, put the hat on, put the coat on, start all over from scratch. Now, story is, well, in real life, Sylvester Stallone is 103, right? But in the movie, he's meant to be in his late 50s. They do refer to him as 50-something, but I think he has actually passed the... What's this? It's not septuagenarian. What's the one before that? Sextagenarian.
I would imagine.
I think he has blown out a birthday cake with 60 candles on it. Anyway,
it would have been so much easier if you just said, I think he's over 60.
I think he is 60. He's in that ballpark.
It doesn't matter. But, you know, play the clip.
He looks better than I... No, I have to set it up first. So anyway, so he's running a restaurant now.
You mean you haven't already?
No, he's running a restaurant now and he goes from table to table saying, yeah, I remember this fight, that fight. And he's not completely fulfilled. His wife has gone, Talia Shire, not there any longer. There's just a gravestone that he lays some flowers on. He's lost contact with his son, who finds it very, very difficult growing up in the shadow of Rocky because, hey, he casts a big shadow. And then, on one of these sports channels, they do a computerised title fight between Rocky Balboa and this new guy, Mason the Line Dixon. You get that? Mason the Line
Dixon.
So they have the computer fight, right? And obviously Rocky wins the computer fight. Then, intense speculation, Mance, as to what would happen if you had a, what'd you go, an exhibition match between Rocky Balboa and Mason the Line Dixon. And somehow, Rocky says, you know, the thing I really want to do...
You've done the impression.
You don't like it?
Not much.
Okay, so he says that he wants to get his self-respect back. And one last time, he's got one last fight in him. So he does the thing where he goes on a tour of all the old locations. He goes to the pet store. He goes to the ice skating rink. He goes up and down the steps. He looks around the old neighbourhood. Things are falling apart. Things aren't what they used to be. He's got to get it back together again with his son. He wants the chance to fight. He goes to the boxing wall. They say, you can't fight. You're 103. And he says, no, but I'm in very good shape. They say, yes, but you're still 103. And then there's a little montage. And then they say, oh, fine, just this once. And the next thing, he's there in the ring. And he has the title fight with the guy who's 12 and he's 103. Now, this may sound like complete rubbish, and indeed, it is complete rubbish, but I would be lying if I didn't say that from the minute that he gets in the ring...
You didn't cry, did you?
...as the underdog. No, but the tears were prickling.
Oh,
he gets in there. Okay, he is the underdog. He's like, he's the geriatric. He's, you know, it's going to be...
Of course, he's a sextagenarian.
He's a sextagenarian, he is. And the other guy is like knee-high to, you know, he's very young, but he's a big guy. And then they start hitting each other. And from the minute they start hitting each other, da-da-da, boom, boom, da-da-da. And you're just sitting there going, yes, yes, yeah, it's absolute pants, but every sort of atom of your rubbish B-movie loving, you know, trash infested being just goes, yes, look at the old guy thump now.
Look at the old guy thump the real boxer.
Thump the really young guy. Now, here's a couple of things to remember. One of the things about Rocky is, of course, that, you know, Rocky doesn't win all the fights. And then, of course, you'll remember from the, you know, the end of the original Rocky, it's the whole thing is that he wins, you know, he wins the love.
He doesn't win this one as well.
That's the most... What I'm saying is, it is actually up in the air as to whether it's going to be... Obviously, we are in, you know, we're in cloud cuckoo land now. We're not in a real world. When the guy gets into the ring with the younger guy puts him out, puts him in a hospital in 5 seconds flat and goes and has a beef burger and a press conference, right? We're not in that world. We're in the world in which Sylvester Stallone can actually get back into the ring after saying he'd have... And you come out of it going, well, you know what? It's absolute rubbish, but I got my money's worth of rubbish. And I came out of it, it ends with a montage of people running up and down those steps, of fans running up and down those steps. And you think, you know what? You kind of earned it.
Chris in London says, who was Mark doing an impression of? Was it Miss Potter?
Yes, Miss Potter. What you mean, just then? Here's the thing.
Just then.
Yeah, okay. Well, actually, so Renee Zellweger wasn't that good as Miss Potter. It would have been better if she'd done Miss Potter like that.
That's the Godfather.
She is a bad... No, the Godfather is... You come to me...
It's the same.
...for my daughter's wedding...
Adam
and
in Brighton.
...and you don't show me no respect.
Whilst watching Sylvester Stallone parading around Goodison Park... Actually, I'll just break off. That's where Everton play football. On promotional duties last Sunday, my wife reminded me that his first Rocky film won an Oscar for Best Picture in 76. I was only 7 at the time, and I was curious to find out the calibre of the other films in the same category. I was surprised and a bit saddened to discover it had beaten, amongst others, Taxi Driver and All the President's Men,
famously,
to this statue. This reminded me of the 1990 ceremony when Costner's Dances with Wolves triumphed, which he put in inverted commas, over Scorsese's Goodfellas. I'm sure there are many other examples of brilliant films being beaten by Pap, but what would the good doctor consider his biggest Oscar travesty? Hey, Oscar conversation, which reminds me, on Tuesday...
Yes, that's right.
See and watch...
See and watch. See and watch. With your eyes and your eyeballs.
And listen.
That's one of those things.
And enjoy.
It's that thing in School of Rock when he says, this is a lesson that will test your mind, your brain, and your head.
Two. Yeah, it's that at the end.
Yeah. Well, worst travesty ever, of course, was the year that Driving Miss Daisy won the Oscar for Best Film and every other film released that year didn't. Because the fact is, it cannot have been a year in which Driving Miss Daisy was better than anything.
James on this email says, afternoon chaps, particularly looking forward to Mark's review of Babel. However, would the good doctor please explain why the UK is among the last country to receive this wonderful film? According to the Internet Movie Database, only Singapore, Hungary and Japan open after us.
Yeah, well, lucky them, frankly. Shall we do it?
Well, I kind of lost interest now. I kind of know which direction this is going in. Anyway, give us some detail.
Babel, or Babel, as people keep calling it. It's the Tower of Babel, right? Not the Tower of Babel. incredibly self-important, you know, festival favourite. It's a winner of the Golden Globe Best Drama Award already. It's been nominated BAFTA Best Film, I think. It's got a very good chance of getting an Oscar nod on Tuesday, I believe, when you can both see and watch us.
Coverage from 1:30.
It's all happening here. Directed by Alejandro González Iñárritu, who started out brilliantly with Amores Perros, which is a really great kind of exploitation-style film. Then he got a bit full of himself with 21 Grams, and people kept saying, you know, oh, you're a really good filmmaker. And now he's turned into basically the filmmaking equivalent of Michael Jackson, doing this kind of platitudinous preaching with delusions of self, you know, world-saving importance. What we have is a series of torturously interconnected stories taking place around the globe in which we all live, because we are the world. America, Mexico, North America, North Africa, Japan, high-profile actors such as Brad Pitt and Kate Blanchett, suffering for their art and showing just how much they really care. Because you know what? If something bad happens anywhere in the world, it reflects on all of us. Here's what the film says. A shot rings out in North Africa and echoes around the world. How long did that take?
About 3 seconds.
Okay, fine. The film takes about 2.5 hours to say exactly that. Whereas Amores Perros had these stories like colliding in a car crash, this has these stories running away from each other at great speed and being roped together. It's like, you know that phrase, it's like herding cats? Well, it's doing these stories is exactly like herding cats. How is that guy in Mexico going to tie up with the guy over there and the woman with no pants in Japan and the guy on the plane from the thing and the blah? Now, when it played in Cannes, and there was this great reverential feeling about it, you know, it's a great world statement from Alejandro González Iñárritu. The film started playing, and there was this, like, hushed reverence in the audience. And I was watching it thinking... And about halfway through, the projector briefly broke down, which it has a habit of doing in Cannes. And it broke down, and there was this silence, this reverential silence in the cinema. And I turned to a very good friend of mine sitting next to me, David.
That's two friends you've got, you've mentioned.
No, I don't have them at the same time. I only rented Ollie, and now I am friends with David.
Be careful how you talk about rentable Ollie.
No. Obviously, I'm making a joke.
Yes.
For legal reasons. Okay. Anyway, and we literally almost as one said to each other, is it me or is this poo? And this kind of ripple of disapproval went through the crowd. No, it's a masterpiece, it's magnifique, how dare you, English pig dog. And then the film starts up again, and you could feel that actually there was a couple of people in the audience going, you know what, there might be some truth in that. And when it gets to the moment when you finally discover why the bit in Japan with the person with no pants is related to the person in Mexico, you can almost hear people go, no, monsieur, no, this, I'm not having this, fine. So anyway, the film gets still rapturous reviews, people saying, you know, work of art, work of genius, work of great thing. Interesting to see that by the time it finally gets to open here, after having opened all around the world, quite a number of critics have now come together and said, you know what, this is just meretricious, self-important twaddle. And I would just like to say that I hated it first. I disliked it halfway through the first screening in Cannes, so consequently I was ahead of the pack. And this is important to me because I don't want people saying, well, you're just saying that because everybody really, really liked it and now the backlash has begun. As I've said before, I was lashing before there was any back to lash at.
Okay, so you hated it first?
Yes.
Unless someone can claim that they hated it before
20
you.
Minutes into that screen. If somebody disliked it before the projector broke down the first
Cannes screening.
When
would this be?
Well, it was May. It was the first ever public screening. It was May of last year, wasn't
okay,
it?
Okay, if you hated Babel earlier than that,
yes.
I think a small prize should be made available.
Yeah, what shall I give them?
I've got no idea. But
I'll tell
sure.
you what, I've got a Sign Exorcist poster going spare.
No, let's not do any.
Okay, fine. It's just one of those things in which, you know, the performances are all fine. It's all, but it is very, very full of itself, and it takes an awfully long time to say something that is ultimately quite fatuous. And as I said, the worst thing about it is the section in Japan is complete nonsense. And any editor worth their salt.
This is where the person, where the woman isn't wearing any underwear.
Yeah,
is that explained?
No, not really. And it's just completely unnecessary, and it's a bit yucky, to be honest. But whilst you're watching the film, you kind of keep thinking, you know, I kind of wish we were back in Japan because at least it was stupid. I mean, this rest of this stuff is just incredibly ponderous and laborious, but any editor worth their salt would have taken that stuff out. And so the best thing about the film is a bit which is basically hasn't got any right to be there and should be in the outtakes on the DVD. Well, there we go. I mean, I really like Alejandro González Iñárritu when he was thinking of himself as an exploitation filmmaker. I think he should get back to exploitation because, honestly, this is art with a capital F, and I don't need it. I mean, I really don't need somebody saying, you know, in the end, we are all just one big, you know, mushy pea. No, we're not. No, we're not. There we go.
Right, moving on.
Black Book.
I think we've got the message of that. Sam in Tunbridge. Mm. Looking forward to hearing the good doctor's thoughts on Paul Verhoeven's first film in 6 years.
Paul Verhoeven.
Was it?
He's Dutch.
From the trailer, I get the impression that this could be his best film since RoboCop. I ought to be watching Black Book as you speak, but I'm homesick instead. I also wonder if Mark shares my feelings that, showgirls aside, Verhoeven is seriously underrated as a director.
Well, look, I'm a big fan of Paul Verhoeven. The famous Dutch filmmaker started out making these films in Holland land, you know, in Dutchish language. And he made films like Die Vier de Man, The Fourth Man, which is absolutely great, which is basically a dry run for Basic Instinct. It's, in many ways, is a better film than Basic Instinct. Then he came to America and he made Total Recall, and RoboCop, and, you know, all, you know, great, interesting science fiction movies. Then he made Basic Instinct, which was a great water cooler movie, sort of, you know, set off the whole mainstream erotic thriller genre going again in the 1990s. And then he effectively torched his career with Showgirls. And if I'm right, I think Showgirls won more Razzie Awards than almost anything else, because I got it down as worst director, worst screenplay, worst actress, worst newcomer, worst screen coupling for any combination of body parts, worst picture, and then later on, worst film of the decade. Then he made Starship Troopers, which, as you'll remember, is a really great bug movie. It's a really interesting sort of story about, you know, it's a metaphorical story about fascism, but it's these Doogie Howser MD fighting bugs out in space, and it's a great film, isn't it?
It is, yes, very good. Excellent film.
Really,
on TV just the other day.
Actually. No, it's just really terrific. And so then he made Hollow Man, which he himself described as his hollow film, isn't it? And it is, he's quite right. And so he went back to Holland, Netherlands, Dutchland, and he's now made this, Black Book, Zwart Book, which is basically...
In general, yeah. Accents, avoid them.
Okay. It's an interesting drama about Nazi-occupied Holland, which, of course, he has dealt with before in Soldier of Orange. I won't do the Dutch title for you. Soldat van Orange. Oh. And it stars a young Jewish woman who, at the beginning of the movie, joins the resistance, and then, because of the way the movie plot unfolds, has to seduce this Nazi guy. And during the course of the movie, their relationship calls into question everyone's identities. It's a typical Paul Verhoeven films are about identity. In RoboCop, is he the guy that he used to be? Is he Murphy or is he RoboCop? In Basic Instinct, is Sharon Stone's character the devil or is she actually this innocent person? In the case of Black Book, what's most interesting is it's not all the Nazis are really terrible and not all the resistance people are really good. And in the combination of this terrible sort of catastrophe that happens, everyone's identity is called into question. Now, it being Verhoeven, of course, it does have sex and violence. In fact, I think on the BBFC website it says contains strong violence, language and sex, and you think, good, but that's a Paul Verhoeven film. And there are occasions when it tips over slightly into Tinto Brass kind of territory. And
what does that mean?
Well, you know,
he's the one who does those saucy films.
Made
Salon
Kitty
mentioned.
And Caligula and that sort of thing. But Salon Kitty is, you know, there is a sort of... There is just the hints of it. Well, not even hints. No, there is full-on sort of exploitation occasionally. But I have nothing against exploitation. But it has a very, very good central performance by a newcomer whose name I'm not even going to try and pronounce. I think it's Caprice Van Houten, I think. Anyway, she's very, very good. Verhoeven's direction, he's back on home ground. He's got substance. He's dealing with stuff that he wants to deal with. The gloves are off. He's not being sort of constrained by all the Hollywood problems that he had with Hollow Man. And yes, it's not perfect. Yes, there are things wrong with it. Yes, there are still great big clodding footprints of the way there always are with Paul Verhoeven, but I think it is his best film in a very, very long time, and good for him, and how nice to see him firing on all cylinders and being, you know, as provocative as he was at his best.
Chris in Canterbury, I hated Babel as soon as I heard Brad Pitt was in it.
Good.
Sam in Lancaster, I hated Babel in March. Brad in Beverly Hills, I hated Babel when I first saw the script.
Oh, really? Well, that does predate me.
This is, I'm considering having a tattoo done on my chest of Mark Kermode. Frankly, I'm scared that the more I think about it, the more it makes sense. I think it's time to leave all that. Movie of the week.
Black Book.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.